This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places, in fact, the very streets of Southern California. I'm Saul Gonzalez of KQED's The California Report, sitting in today for Steve Chiatakis. Crenshaw Boulevard. It rolls more than 23 miles down from the mansions of Hancock Park to the cliffs of Palos Verdes. And on the way, it crosses freeways and streets with names dear to the Black community.
That section of the 10 freeway is Rosa Parks Freeway. It goes down, then you have Obama Boulevard, you have Martin Luther King, and then it even crosses Slauson, which is Nipsey Hussle Square.
That's Shaka Satori. He's a community activist from Leimert Park describing Crenshaw Boulevard.
We identify it as the main artery of Black culture here in Los Angeles.
But the man Crenshaw's named for was actually white. So maybe it's not surprising that nearly 20 years ago, someone actually tried to change Crenshaw's name. You probably noticed it didn't work. Why not? As part of our Greater LA series on street names, reporter Mike Schlitt takes us back to 2003, when a fight over the name Crenshaw divided the neighborhood.
So who named Crenshaw Boulevard? George Lafayette Crenshaw, that's who. Back in 1904, he was building middle-class neighborhoods all over South LA, and when he named Crenshaw Boulevard, Black people weren't allowed to live anywhere near it.
Crenshaw, I mean, he's a guy who supported protective covenants. That being the case, we should change the name.
That's Nate Holden. He's retired now at 91, but he used to be a city council member for LA's 10th district, which includes a big stretch of Crenshaw Boulevard. And when he says covenants, he means agreements that were written into property deeds forbidding anyone from selling a house to a non-white person.
The people who were denied the right or privilege to live here. Things change from generation to generation.
The African-American community grew up around Central Avenue, say from 15th down to Slauson.
That's local historian Allison Rose Jefferson.
And as the restrictive racial covenants were broken down, African-Americans started moving west.
By the 1950s, they started moving to Crenshaw.
Black people, middle-class people, were moving into those nicer houses, Leimert Park, Baldwin Hills, View Park. By the time you get to the late 60s, early 70s, you have more African-American small businesses that are opening up amongst the white businesses that are there, and some of them are pretty high profile. You have a couple of nightclubs, Maverick Flats, that was really popular, the Total Experience, which just burned down. And yeah, it became a very important place for some Black middle-class people to move.
Remember how Nate Holden said Crenshaw supported protective covenants? And then he said,
that being the case, we should change the name.
Well, it was Nate Holden's idea to change the street name.
In 2003, as Nate Holden was leaving office, he kind of, as a last gesture, proposed renaming Crenshaw Tom Bradley Boulevard.
That's journalist Aaron Aubrey Kaplan.
Tom Bradley was a hero of that civil rights generation.
He represented his district, the 10th district, up for maybe 50 years.
Tom Bradley's 50-year career started with 20 years as a Crenshaw cop, then 10 more years as an LA City Council member, and finally 20 years as the city's first and only Black mayor. Here he is making a speech just after he retired in 1993.
Racism is a serious threat to this nation. We've got poverty, we've got crime, we've got drugs, we've got problems in education and all of the rest of it. But if we don't understand the nature of racial diversity and the problems related to it, I dare say that we are going to have a real problem on our hand.
Tom Bradley died in 1998. If you want to rename a street in Los Angeles, you need the city council to vote for it. So 1 week before Nate Holden's planned retirement in 2003, he introduced a motion to rename a seven-mile stretch of Crenshaw
Tom Bradley Boulevard.
Tom Bradley Boulevard. It would be a celebration of Tom Bradley's legacy and an illustration of Nate Holden's power.
Mr. President, members, and I respectfully request that we have a unanimous vote for this change.
There's a call. call your name. I'll call three.
The room is packed with Crenshaw residents. The council will hear arguments for and against the proposal, and then they'll vote. But it kind of feels like a coronation.
Tom Bradley is a world citizen.
Tom Bradley, the man.
Tom Bradley, the mayor.
Tom Bradley, the civil activist.
You pay tribute to his legacy. You do honor to yourselves.
Thank you very much.
And then?
Ms. Galanter.
Councilmember Ruth Galanter takes the mic. Galanter is white, and she represents the northern part of the San Fernando Valley.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to point out, as I pointed out the other day, we already have a Tom Bradley Boulevard here in the city of Los Angeles.
That's true. Tom Bradley Boulevard is just a few blocks long and right by City Hall.
Can I have order, please?
Okay, wait. You're on my time, guys. I only get 3 minutes here. How many Tom Bradley Boulevards do we need? We have. Wait.
Nate Holden figured this would be a no-brainer. Not only did he not really get support for this proposal, but he got active opposition.
But it wasn't just opposition from people in the valley. Here's Leimert Park activist Shaka Satori.
This is a motion based on a couple of phone calls based on Councilman Nate Holden's decision that it's going to be Tom Bradley Boulevard. The community was never intended to be represented. There was never any efforts made. At least see what the people want. But at least let the people decide. No more good old boy behind the scenes, closed door, sidebar politics, please.
Nate Holden says his team collected thousands of signatures, but Aaron Aubrey Kaplan says his proposal had a much bigger problem.
There was also a sense that Tom Bradley, you know, in retrospect, was not very good for South Central LA and Crenshaw as mayor. I mean, his political attentions were downtown on the west side. He did forge these coalitions that people felt were very historic. But in the end, South Central, as my father used to say, went down on his watch.
It was the beating of Rodney King. Four LAPD officers were charged.
In the aftermath of 92, there was a lot of talk from local politicians about, oh, we're going to do this and going to do that. We're going to rebuild these neighborhoods because Crenshaw suffered a lot of damage. And not much happened. People really felt that elected officials on some level were failing them.
When Nate Holden proposed renaming Crenshaw after Tom Bradley, was he just trying to honor a local black hero? After all, Nate Holden was Bradley's political rival. They ran against each other in a bitter mayoral race. So what was this all about? Was it just a move towards a new name? Or was Nate Holden also suggesting the community abandon the old one and all that the name Crenshaw now implied?
Crenshaw became, you know, sort of an international symbol of Black LA. People talk about the Shaw. The Shaw was the boulevard. Some people would complain, oh, this is stereotypical, but others were kind of proud that it was on the map.
Nate Holden was not one of those people. Here he is at the 2003 hearing.
We just have cruises and bruises in the Crenshaw area. People have said, I drive by Crenshaw, but I will not drive on Crenshaw.
As it stands now, Crenshaw is but a mere shadow of its former glory days.
That's renaming advocate Melanie Lomax, Tom Bradley's goddaughter.
I believe that Tom Bradley would give this major artery a tremendous boost and the image that is more in line with the aspirations of most of its residents and business owners.
Which leads us to Nate Holden's closing argument and one of the last public statements he made as an LA City Council member.
And I think that we can bring some civility to that community. Thank you very much.
I think he should have and could have used better words than that, specifically the word civility. To say it would bring civility is to infer that it doesn't already have it.
That's Shaka Satori again. He's got another problem with what Nate Holden was doing. He and other Crenshaw residents had already been working for 8 years on renaming a portion of Crenshaw Boulevard, but these guys weren't advocating for Tom Bradley. They had someone else in mind.
Malcolm X is a symbol in history. And even if you're not black, if you've been destitute, if you've been marginalized, if you've been discriminated against.
Tory Brandon Reese is a Leimert Park artist, and some call him an activist, although...
In fact, I don't call myself activist. I call myself a cultural advocate.
Back in the 90s, he got 20,000 signatures in support of the Malcolm X proposal, but no response from City Hall, although he seems to have gotten someone's attention.
It could be that Nate Holden got the idea from the Malcolm X effort. I don't know for sure, but I think that there is a connection.
Well, that's not what Nate Holden says.
for whatever reason, some people might say, well, we don't want Nate Holden to get credit for it. The name change.
I think that this was Nate Holden's version of street naming, and this was the proper name. This is what we should be naming streets after, respectable people.
And when the city council finally voted on changing Crenshaw Boulevard to Tom Bradley Boulevard?
Please close the roll and tabulate the vote.
6 ayes, 6 noes.
Okay, that does not pass.
A follow-up vote unanimously sent the proposal back to committee for further review and more community input. Nate Holden retired just a week later, and his proposal to rename Crenshaw Boulevard?
It died. And this was Nate Holden's idea anyway. You know, like I said, no one was sitting around thinking about doing this. And once he was gone, there was no real reason to continue with it.
These days, Shaka Satori and Tori Brandon Reese are working on a new proposal. And this time, instead of replacing Crenshaw with Malcolm X, they want to place them right next to each other. A co-naming.
Malcolm X, to this day, is still looked at as a controversial figure. And what does controversy mean? America is controversial, but who writes the history gets to dictate the story.
On Crenshaw, that remains to be seen. But for now, one of the streets most closely associated with LA's Black community is still named after a guy who built houses exclusively for white people. For Greater LA, on Crenshaw Boulevard, I'm Mike Schlitt.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA. I'm Saul Gonzalez in for Steve Chiatakis. It's spring, and that means many of us feel this urge to do something, anything in the garden. And the pandemic cultivated a lot of new gardeners. But how do you decide what to plant? And how do you take care of it? And how do you avoid blowing your entire paycheck at your local nursery? Answering those questions can turn what's supposed to be a de-stressor into an anxiety-producing experience. So we made a horticultural 911 call. And help has arrived in the form of Tashonda Giles-Jones. Based in Inglewood, she teaches 6th to 8th grade at Environmental Charter Middle School and heads up gardening classes through Kiss the Ground, an LA nonprofit rooted in the healthy soil movement. Thanks for joining us, Tashonda.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
All right, let's get to it. We asked our listeners what questions they had about their gardens this season, and we heard from a lot of people. Let's start with David Santos. He asked, I thought, a great elemental question. How do you know if you have good dirt? And if you don't have good dirt, what do you buy?
Ooh, yes. The dirt versus soil question.
Uh-oh.
That is a question I get all the time. And the first thing I start with, especially with my middle schoolers, is dirt is not soil. Dirt has no living, no life in it. Soil is full of life. And one teaspoon of soil, you can have millions of microbes present. And that is the difference. Once you can determine if you have dirt or soil, if you can rebuild what's back there already, compost is a really great way to amend it. But I always go with sheet mulching, especially if you have the space for it. And sheet mulching is using cardboard, taking all of the stickers or any kind of adhesive off of it first, because remember, it's going to break down and you don't want that adhesive or toxins in your soil. But what you would do is cover your dirt or the soil you want to amend to make healthier with cardboard overlapping. This process helps smother any weed seeds that are presently there. You wet it, drench it so it's nice and soggy. And then the trick is to cover it with mulch. Now, mulch is what helps suppress that cardboard. And as you leave it there over time, and I've seen it happen in a few months, that cardboard starts to break down, that moisture is trapped under the mulch, and then it starts creating this inviting habitat for some of those microbes and decomposers to come back.
All right. Great response. Very comprehensive. Let's move to our next question. Let's take one from Cameron Young, who asks, since summer is just around the corner, it's going to get hot, what should gardeners do to protect their plants from intense heat and sunshine? And if you could also take the short and long view, the short view is what did they do this summer? And then just looking in the years ahead, what should they plant given, you know, we're living on a planet with a changing climate?
Such a good question. Climate adaptive plants, trees is a big conversation in the garden world because with climate change, our zonings are shifting. And so some things you can do now is make sure that you are planting those plants that can handle really warm temperatures in the soil. And so those are going to be like our tomatoes and our eggplants, our corn, our squash. Now, what you can do is do a little companion planting that can help shade some of those crops that are less heat tolerant. I always do a canopy type of gardening where I'm growing things that are taller that can naturally shade some of my leafy greens that are going to be closer to the soil. I also would look at the area you're growing in. You know, use buildings as shade. If you have trees in your backyard, if you're planting on a balcony, pay attention to the way the sun hits your growing space and then modify that way.
And is there like one plant you could suggest for Southern California and our climatic zones here that's just really good? It's just a really good contender for hot summers, hot climate, and is drought tolerant?
You know, I mean, I believe in, especially if you're a beginning gardener and you want to see success, tomatoes are the way to go. Uh-huh. They're long growing and they're prolific givers. And so they do really well in hot weather. The warmer it is, the sweeter the tomatoes can be. You can taste the sun in the tomatoes when it's really hot. So those are my go-tos. Those are my favorites. And peppers.
Another great question, a pertinent one. It comes from Gretchen. She really likes you, by the way. I'm told to let you know that you rock from Gretchen. She has a question about promoting native plants in our city. I guess she sees them in street medians and in parks and in other places that the city manages. If you want to promote native plants, if you want to plant native plants, what should you be doing?
Oh, that's such a great question. And thank you, Gretchen. I appreciate your kind words. It's actually really exciting to learn the history of the plants that do well in this area and which plants were actually introduced that we consider to be natives that really aren't native, but have been here for, you know, hundreds of years. And I would say this is not the only place that you can go to, but I think Theodore Payne Foundation is an awesome start. They are leaders in native plant horticulture. Not only do they provide education, so if you are really interested in learning more about natives and getting involved in planting natives in your community, they're a go-to. They have a nursery. They are cultivating natives, not only that we have had here, but looking at natives that are adaptable to our climate change. They provide springtime garden tours. So you can go onto their website and look and see what communities are near you where people have planted natives on their land. And you can go and tour and see what it looks like and talk to those homeowners and see what their journey was like. They also are really good at providing opportunities for people to engage in community organizations who want to plant in their community. So learn about your natives first, and then start looking at your local nurseries and see who's providing them. Get to know those local nurseries and see what kind of outreach they have available.
And a follow-up question to that, are there things that we shouldn't be planting that were maybe popular a generation or two ago, but given the drought situation, given the climate situation, are there things that just shouldn't be going into the ground anymore in Southern California?
You know what? And there are definitely species that come and go from year to year that they'll say, you know, this, we shouldn't be planting this. If certain listeners have been reading, I think LA Times had an article a little while back that talked about butterfly weed and the type that the tropical type that's been planted. There was a big boom on getting those plants into the ground a few years ago. And now there's been a realization that no, there's another type of butterfly bush that should be planted for our migrating monarchs. And we see that over time, right? I do lean towards more of the natives that can support and promote habitat and food for native animals and insects that live here in California. And I think that's where I am always leaning towards. It doesn't mean that I don't plant non-natives with my natives as well, but it has to make sense to my space. As a gardener, I am only planting things that can create food for a human or another organism, that can create a habitat, create shade, that helps with carbon sequestering. So if that means it's a non-native plant, I'm researching that plant, that tree, to make sure that it can coexist in the space that I'm putting it, and that, again, it provides some kind of benefit. So I kind of leave that up to people. And yes, lean more towards native.
Huh. And finally, we got a question from a KCRW employee, Brittany, who asks, what are some relatively safe and non-toxic ways to deal with aphids and spider mites on flowering and fruiting plants?
Those aphids. Now, I did just tell you previously, tomatoes are a great way to go because they're givers.
You did. I heard you.
Right. But they are also super attractors of aphids. You know, aphids, they can attack a lot of different plants, and there are a lot of different species of aphids. They come in different colors and sizes. Some of them look a lot gnarlier than others. But they are a normal type of pest you would find in a garden. My go-to is always a biological control, and that is introducing beneficial bugs into your garden. I'm a true believer in a balanced ecosystem, and in a balanced ecosystem, you don't eliminate anything. You just create balance. And so introducing ladybugs, lacewing, and parasitic wasps into your garden, planting plants and flowers that attract them will help keep that aphid population down. Also, the health of your soil. If your soil is healthy, your plant is likely to be more healthy. Think of it as a human body. If you are eating healthy, your body is able to withstand disease and getting sick a lot better than if you're not as healthy. Plants are the same way. Aphids come in droves. It really depends on climate too. I remember a couple of years ago, the aphid population shot up. We had a really rainy season and then got really, really hot right after. And that was like perfect for aphids. The true fire way to take care of them, if you're going out into your garden every morning, is manually dealing with it while you're waiting for all those beneficial bugs to come in. A high powered hose on your plant, if it's an established plant, can go ahead and wash those aphids off. I've even gone out there and just like run my hand over plants and squish the aphids out of the way. But that requires a consistency because they will come right back. There are some sprays you can use. So people have used neem oil. That tends to work. I researched a couple of interesting ones that I haven't tried yet, but tomato leaf spray, taking tomato leaves and crushing them up, making a liquid out of them and spraying your plants. I haven't used that one, so I'm not sure I'm interested. I will probably try it out. I've heard of garlic oil sprays working for gardeners in the past, just steeping garlic cloves in some water and with a little bit of dishwater. But scientifically, those biological controls are going to be your best bet.
Wow. You know, I have learned so much. I can feel my thumb getting greener already during this conversation. Tashonda Giles-Jones is an outdoor educator at Environmental Charter Middle School in Inglewood. You can also check out her great online classes on regenerative gardening at kisstheground.com/stewardship. Tashonda, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. Happy gardening.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez, sitting in for Steve Chiatakis. And finally today, some art. A couple of Los Angeles-based artists are exhibiting work in two new shows that draw on a similar theme, looking into the past. Those exhibits are called Lacuna and Fool's Errand, and they explore themes of memory, time, childhood, and family. Our art insider, Lindsay Preston-Zappas, is here to tell us more. She's the editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hey, Lindsay.
Hi, Saul.
So let's start with the exhibit titled Lacuna. This is from the artist Faye Ray at Shulamit Nazarian in Hollywood. Tell us more about the exhibit.
Yeah, so the show is made up of several large aluminum metal mobiles. So these are things that are kind of, you know, suspect to gravity, and they hang throughout the space. And they're made up of various pieces of metal that are chained together in different configurations. But then Faye also mixes in objects like abalone and driftwood or seashells and corn. So some of these are actually cast in metal aluminum as well. And she sort of beads them on almost like a charm bracelet. And, you know, each of these objects that she uses, like the corn, for instance, it just starts to feel very symbolic. Like she's really chosen it to be there for a reason.
And this idea of the past and looking backward to draw inspiration, how does Faye Ray do that in her work exactly?
Right. So I mentioned, you know, there's all these objects, right, that I'm kind of calling charms here that Faye incorporates into the mobiles. And each one of these really relates to a specific childhood memory or an aspect of Faye's family history. So for example, there's a large work in the show that uses abalone shells, and Ray talks about how her father used to make abalone in the backyard, and they would eat it with lime and salt, and she has this very clear memory of this. And then the metal itself is actually connected to Faye's family history. A lot of her family was involved in agriculture or transport, and her father actually had a hauling company and often transported aluminum metal sheets and scraps.
I grew up going into a lot of different kind of junkyards and truck yards where there were big rig diesel parts all over the place and like rocks to climb and seashells to collect and machine matter, natural matter everywhere that kind of took our imaginations.
Wow, she really relates an interesting experience. And let's turn to this other exhibit, Fool's Errand. It's from artist Sessa England. Walk us through that show.
Yeah, so this is a beautiful solo show at Hunter Shaw Fine Art in Mid-City. And the work takes on various forms of sculpture and installation. So when you first walk in, you see kind of like a domestic or interior space. There's these sculptures that look almost like shelving. And then there's flat pieces on the floor that almost feel like rugs. But the lights are turned off. The gallery is lit only by the storefront window. So there's sort of this moodiness when you walk in. And as you get closer, you realize that these wooden shelves that the artist actually refers to as skeletons, which is really interesting. You see these sheets of latex that kind of lay down across these shelves. There's one where this piece of latex actually hangs down over a hanger on one of these shelf-like structures, sort of like fresh pasta hung out to dry. So there's a really interesting translucency to this material, this latex material, that's only lit through this natural lighting from the window. And then on the walls, there's these large hooks. They're kind of like oversized piercings, like an eyebrow piercing. And then dangling down are these big chain necklaces that dangle onto the floor. And there's, again, charms. That's like the buzzword for this segment. There's wooden butterfly charms kind of attached to the bottom of these things.
Well, we frame this conversation as one about artists that are drawing on the past in their work. How does Sessa do that in this show, Fool's Errand?
So yeah, the artist actually tattoos and pierces this latex material. They give them stick and poke tattoos. So that to me feels really nostalgic. It kind of takes me back to getting my ears pierced at the mall at Claire's. But then there's also a bunch of 90s culture and ephemera that's sprinkled through the show that isn't immediately obvious at first glance. So for instance, some of these tattoos are in the shape of smiley faces or butterflies. And there's actually hidden troll dolls throughout this show. So Sessa casts them into tin and then uses them as charms on these large necklace pieces or as feet in the shelf sculptures. So, you know, it's a bit deceptive because you don't instantly walk in and think, oh my gosh, we're in the 90s, but it's used in a really smart, subtle, and moody way.
So finally, how long will the shows be up for and where can people go to check them out?
Right. So Faye's show is up in Hollywood at Shulamit Nazarian. That one's through June 26th. And Sessa England at Hunter Shaw Fine Art in Mid-City, that one's through July 4th. And just in terms of appointments, Saul, the galleries are opening up. You know, they've been open and they're kind of in this transition moment where we've talked about how appointments have been required throughout the pandemic to get into galleries. And now there's sort of this transient moment where appointments are encouraged, but walk-ins are also totally okay. So essentially, you can just show up to these shows. But I will say masks are definitely still required for the time being.
All right. Lindsay Preston-Zappas, Editor-in-Chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
And that's Greater LA for today. Next week, more drones are coming to an airspace near you. Oh no. What is that going to look and sound like? You can check out any of our stories online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, John Meek, Mario Saavedra, Bill Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Taw, Michael Vogel, and Christian Bardal all help put today's show together. I'm Saul Gonzalez. Have a great night.